WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. We voyage into the vegetable kingdom on this week's show with America's vegetarian cooking pioneer, Deborah Madison. Her new book is called Vegetable Literacy, and it will change the way you view vegetables. Then Amy Lawrence and Justin Fox Burks have a topsy-turvy way of cooking up the traditional Southern meat in three on their blog, The Chubby Vegetarian. That's right, there's no meat at all. And Gia DeLeo of Green To Go joins us with her new twist on fresh, healthy street food served from an old-school bike. Get ready for a vegetable revelation on this week's Louisiana Eats. Deborah Madison is one of my food heroes. Deborah's a food activist who was instrumental in creating the food revolution of the 1970s. She's a cooking teacher and the author of multiple award-winning books that are considered seminal classics of the American food revolution. And I have to admit, I am really honored to call Deborah my friend. So, till at long last, Deborah Madison, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. You're one of my favorites, too.
Well, from the start, your books have always been very veg and fruit-centric. Yet, what's fascinating to me, I think a lot of people might not suspect, you're not strictly a vegetarian, are you?
I'm not. I was for about 20 years, pretty much a vegetarian, until I started working at Chez Panisse. And then, of course, I had to taste everything. I've always chosen to say that I'm not. If I go out to dinner, I don't want to be the person who makes some poor woman jump through hoops to accommodate me. I really, really don't. I feel strongly about that. But also, I decided a long time ago that if I went on the road in public as a vegetarian pushing some sort of a food regime, the question I would have all my life would be, do you get enough protein? And that's just not what I was interested in. I was so much more interested in how is food growing, how are animals raised, how are we going about providing food for ourselves in our world? That's what really interests me.
Well, you have never been the in-your-face activist. You have found the quietest, most approachable way to take us all to your table with you. And I'd like you to take us back to your start at the San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara. And you studied there at the Zen Center for 18 years. So how did those experiences form your way of eating and thinking about food?
Well, I think actually probably the food itself is what informed me because I was very interested in cooking when I became a Zen student. That was already part of who I was. And then all of a sudden I'm in this community in the late 60s eating just the most horrible food. You know, I mean, it was really the food of the cliched brown food vegetarian menu.
The gruel.
You know, it was heavy. Nobody knew how to cook it. Intentions were good to move away from processed food to get back to cooking from scratch. But, you know, no one had a clue. And I became the head cook pretty much early on. And I really didn't care that it was vegetarian. I just wanted to cook. And I had some real challenges, one being, how do you bring everyone to the table if you're serving food that people don't recognize, that they don't particularly like, that's really radically different from how they grew up? So,
how'd you do that?
I introduced butter. Butter played a very important role. I mean, the person who preceded me was a macrobiotic cook, and he was a really good cook. I forever admire him. But macrobiotic didn't always approve of things like baking powder or leavening or eggs. So, yeah, I introduced butter, you know, things that we're actually trying to get away from. But people could relate to this food. Maybe it was we had to go back a few steps in order to go forward.
Well, I just love the whole trip of your life. It's one of my favorites. And this new stop that you've taken us to, the new book, Vegetable Literacy. Deborah, this whole new approach you took of looking at the plant kingdom. So how did you come to this point where we're in the plant kingdom now?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I think there were probably several routes. One was I started gardening, and then you start noticing things. I come from a family of botanists, so plants have long been on my mind. Even though I'm not a botanist, it's something that's been there in the background. And I also became aware of farmers at the market mislabeling produce or not giving it names and making our real knowledge of it sort of obscure or hard to obtain. And I thought, why don't we know a little bit more about them? It makes it a whole lot more fun. So there were a number of things that came together.
This didn't really start off as a cookbook, did it?
Oh, no. I thought maybe there'd be 20 recipes or something.
Yeah, and how many ended up in there?
Yeah, about 300. But, you know, that's what happens. I mean, if you write cookbooks, you don't really get to write anything else. Actually, I'm rather glad now because it does give people a handle to process this other information, which most people probably, you know, plant families, all of that, may not find as exciting as I do. So having some recipes that relate to them, I think, probably is a good thing.
You made it very approachable. And also, some people will also be a little surprised by some of the things that you're encouraging them to eat. So what do you think are some of the stretches? Like, there's some wild foods.
Well, I think, too, it depends on where we are. There is more of an interest in wild foods. But wild spinach, for example, or lamb's quarters, as it's commonly known, and where I live in the Southwest, it's called quelites. Traditional people here always eat that. It's always a weed in the garden. Now some of the farmers have started selling it at the farmer's market. And then you discover, gosh, it doesn't taste that different from spinach. Why not use it? It's in the garden. It's growing among the potatoes or whatever. So I think that things that people may be surprised by is eating chard that's already decided to bolt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tell a story about picking off all these long, long stems, and the leaves get smaller and smaller and further apart. And I was taking it to the compost, and I thought, wait a minute, I wonder if you can eat these. Took it all back into the kitchen. I pulled off the leaves. I chopped up the stems and cooked them, and yeah, you can. But their flavor changes a little bit. It's a little bit more wild and a little bit stronger. It's not quite like the big, fleshy, lovely, large leaves you buy at the market. So having a garden just opens your eyes. It makes you see possibilities that you wouldn't see if you didn't have a garden.
I was really fascinated by a lot of your recommendations on utilizing the whole plant, the things that usually go into the compost heap, and that's a perfect example of it.
Oh, yeah. But also, I mean, you can go to the store, buy a bunch of radishes,
mm-hmm.
and those leaves, whether you grew them or somebody else did, are perfectly edible. And in fact, that's where the nutrition is in the leaves, not in the roots. So, hey, you might as well put them in a soup or a salad or do something with them.
Well, when you came at this approach to vegetables from this familial point of view, how did it begin to inform your recipe development?
In a way, it didn't too much because I didn't have the goal of putting family members together. But I did start thinking, for example, in the sunflower family or Asteraceae, that you have all these really kind of difficult vegetables that are thorny or they have spines or they're bitter or they have a lot of hair on their roots. They're not the easiest group of vegetables, but you do have two oils that come out of that family. You have sunflower seed oil and you have safflower oil. I kind of like staying within the same family. I always feel that you are somehow unearthing a bigger flavor or aspect when you do that, but it's not the goal of the book necessarily to do that.
Well, you're a cooking teacher too, and the way that you write and the way you approach things, I often see the cooking teacher at work there. Talk to me about kitchen wisdom.
Well, I don't know what to say, and I haven't been a cooking teacher for a while, but I mean, you pick it up, you know. You're a good cook, and you just keep doing the same things more or less over and over again, and suddenly you find you're listening to your pan instead of just looking at it or looking at a timer or a clock or a recipe. You're picking up the sound of something starting to sizzle that wasn't sizzling before, and somehow you know, oh, it's time to add that wine or that liquid or whatever it is. To me, that's a kind of kitchen wisdom, and it just comes with doing whatever you do a lot. It doesn't have to do with it being complicated or knowing a lot of different stuff, but just being there.
I would like you to play the soothsayer for us.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I want to know what you believe the future of food holds for us all.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, it's pretty depressing, actually, the future of food. You know, I can come down on two sides. I think more and more those of us who want real food and food that's really full of nutrition and that's not going to harm us and that we love and enjoy, I think more and more we have to go underground, we have to fight hard for it, we have to get it for ourselves, we have to make a special effort. It's not easy. You know, there's just too much out there that's getting in the way, the GMOs, the this, the that, and I, for one, am really sick of reading labels.
Yeah, boy, is that the truth.
You know, so if we care about these things, flavor and also the nutritious side of it, we have to look at soil, and we have to look at varieties. We have to kind of take charge in a way that we haven't had to do for a generation or two. I think that's starting to happen on a lot of levels, lots of levels. So, I mean, it is possible to do it, but it has to be done.
There certainly is a lot more urban growing going on that's ever happened. You know, rooftops in New York City and abandoned lots in New Orleans. It's all being grown with something edible.
Yeah, it's amazing. I did see a garden in West Oakland that was made by the city slickers. I came away from that garden feeling like there's really hope, you know? It was so good. It was so encouraging to see this beautiful food being grown for this particular neighborhood. It was awesome.
Well, I am so incredibly grateful that you carved out this time for me and my Louisiana Eats listeners. We've been waiting for you a long time. So will you please come back and talk to us again?
I would love to.
Deborah Madison and her beautiful new book, Vegetable Literacy.
We are stars. We are gorgeous. We are
Where in the world is Jill Benson? The way this roving reporter covers our state, that's anyone's guess. Jill, where are we going today?
Poppy, we're going to be hitting up the Secret Sunday Supper Series at Maison Madeleine.
And where is that?
It is located on the banks of spectacular Lake Martin, just outside of Brobridge.
So what can you expect at this Sunday supper?
Well, there's a structure on the property at Maison Madeleine, and it's called T-Boy's Bejeum.
Bejeum? What is that?
Bejeum is a 15th century West African term for fall down, and bejeums were popular during Prohibition. People would head to the bejeum to work on falling down. So Madeleine Sinek, the lady who owns Maison Madeleine, and her partner, Walter Adams, built with reclaimed materials, T-Boy's Bejeum. And within this small space, there is a well-equipped professional kitchen. They've begun inviting chefs, rising star chefs from throughout the South, to come and cook Sunday suppers at Maison Madeleine.
Well, this sounds like the James Beard House of the South.
That is exactly what they're trying to establish. They want want chefs to feel that cooking a dinner or being invited to cook for the Secret Sunday Supper series at Maison Madeleine is every bit as much a rite of passage for a young Southern chef as cooking at the James Beard House would be.
So how did this all get started? First, it was a bed and breakfast?
Well, Madeleine Snack found an abandoned old home in Perry, Louisiana, and had it moved to the banks of Lake Martin. She fully restored the house and started to operate it as a bed and breakfast. So there's the main house, and then there's a glass breezeway linking the main house to another structure, which houses the kitchen in a space where musicians perform. And in my opinion, the addition appears to be older than the main house.
Wow, how could that be?
Well, it's because of the construction methods that they used. The walls are all constructed of bousillage.
Oh, this is the old stuff that Cajuns used to use to make their houses.
This is exactly right. So these balls of moss and clay would be rolled and packed between the boards used to construct the walls. Well, as Madeleine says, smooshed into the walls. And then the walls would be hatched and dried, and they have a tremendous amount of texture and interest. It's very hard to believe that this newly built structure is older than the original home.
So this new bejume, the back house, mm-hmm. there's a state-of-the-art modern kitchen in there.
In addition to this marvelous kitchen that all of these chefs are so excited about, there's an intimate and interesting bar in there that was modeled after Snake and Jake's Oak Street, complete with Christmas lights and other weird things that they've found along the way. And the thought is that when chefs or their staff, they can hang out in this bar, watch a sporting event on television, whatever,
and just have some fun,
and they can just relax and have some fun, but also to service the chefs. There's a full exterior bathroom with a shower. They want them to feel very happy and pampered and to look forward to coming and working at Maison Madeleine.
So how can our Louisiana Eats visitors get lucky enough to find out when there's going to be another Secret Supper?
Easy enough. Go to MaisonMadeleine.com, and that's the French spelling, MadeleineE.com, and simply send a message asking to be added to the Secret Sunday Supper list. The site will list the chefs paired with their dates, what the cost is to attend. Dinners will be for between 20 and 35 people, so they'll be keeping the gatherings intimate.
Well, let's plan a road trip, Jill. I'm ready to go.
Let's go, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Jill Benson.
On the road again, going places that I've never been.
We'll be back from a short break with Gia DeLeo's fresh, healthy take on street food served from a bike. Stay tuned.
On the road again.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is one of the young pioneering new wave of farmers. He farms on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, on family land where his father organically raised pigs in a time before organics was a hot buzzword.
Had it not been for my dad stressing the importance of organics and also taking care of the environment and the soil which you're pulling your livelihood from, then I don't think that I would be an organic farmer today. I think that I would have taken a much different path.
In a place that's fueled on the Monday tradition of red beans and rice, our culinary heritage hero turned heads at farmers markets by offering fresh red beans, something we'd never seen in the city before.
There's quite a few old-timers in my area, Waldheim, Bush area, that still grow fresh red beans and market them. And I was really inspired by the older conventional farmers growing them, you know. Unlike a green bean that you pick, you know, still snappy and fresh, the red beans are actually allowed to fill seed in the pods and then harvested before they're dried. So there's a very, very brief window when they're able to be harvested before they dry.
This week's Culinary Heroes vision for making our planet better inspired Chef Matt Murphy, who was the executive chef at the Ritz-Carlton, to begin an incredible composting program.
He has a large walk-in cooler dedicated to saving vegetable scraps. So when we pick it up, it's 36 degrees. Most of it is brought back, given to the chickens fresh, you know, and that leads to a better egg for Matt to use, a better quail egg as well. And the rest of it, pineapple tops, citrus peels, watermelon rinds, asparagus ends, onion skins, carrot peels, parsnip peels, all and many, many more vegetables and fruits, all of that is composted immediately and used to grow more produce to bring back to Matt.
That's why Nick Usner of Grow Farm in Bush is our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero of the Week, brought to you with support by Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations, Nick. Please bring some more fresh beans back to the city. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. On Louisiana Eats, we think food trucks are incredible culinary incubators, which makes them one of our very favorite topics to discuss. We have a guest who sort of has a food truck business, but there's no truck involved. Instead, Gia DeLeo of Green to Go runs her business from a bike. Gia, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. I'm pleased to be here.
So how did you dream up Green to Go?
Well, I started with the concept of a restaurant and scaled down from there and continued to scale and continued to scale. And that's how I came up with the bike.
So when did this begin? And tell me about the early days of Green to Go.
About 2 years ago, I had just had my second child, and I thought I really want something fresh and healthy to eat. But everywhere is going to require sitting down. And I have a newborn. I'm not going out with a newborn, and I'm not subjecting other people to that. And that's where the idea came from. And if nobody else is going to do it, well, then I'm going to do it myself.
Okay. So then how does the bike part come in?
I looked at a traditional restaurant. As a matter of fact, I looked near my house on Ferret Street, which is booming. And 2 years ago, was in this major growth spurt. I looked at a space, and we had almost signed, and then it kind of fell through. And I thought, whew, because this is a city known for gluttony.
Oh, yeah.
And I am trying to push salads. Like, this could be a disaster.
The salad pusher.
Yes.
The salad pusher.
So it was kind of with a sense of relief that we didn't go the traditional route. And my realtor said, why don't you think about a food truck? But, you know, food trucks are made for fast food. So you're talking fryers and grills and all of these things that I just didn't need. So I started looking at these very progressive cities all over the country and frankly, all over the world. And the bike kept coming up. And I thought, you know what? I can do this because it also fits within our concept of being green.
Okay. So you roll out in the street. Tell us this on the street experience.
Well, the bike is great. It is a Worksman cycle, which is the oldest American manufacturer of bicycles. It's fantastic. It's got this large box on the front that fits about 100 salads and drinks. And as long as you don't take a turn too fast, it's pretty stable.
So then you're not tossing your salads in the street. You're heading out with them already tossed.
Yes. Any tossing that goes on just has to do with the New Orleans city streets.
And how did you decide on your routes? Where do you go?
I started at places that I knew. So I started where my boys went to school, which was at the JCC. And the teachers can't leave because they're with the kids and they want fresh, healthy food. Then we added a two-lane stop in Loyola. And these are the media savvy, internet savvy customers are really, you know, the younger crowd. So they know how to work Facebook. They know how to find our posts. They know how to find our menus. And they're all over it. They want organic. They want local.
And how, so let's say maybe you're not a media savvy college mm-hmm. student. How do you find the bike?
It's easy. If you don't even want to pick up your computer and look at the internet, just call me. Just call me. If you want to be as low tech as possible, just give me a call and I'll tell you where we're going to be from day to day. But if you are internet savvy, then you can go on to our Facebook, which is Green to Go NOLA.
Uh-huh.
And you can see on a day-to-day basis where we're going to be.
And you just find a place and park the bike and stay there until you've sold through? Or
well, actually, our customers pre-order.
Oh, so you're doing a lot of delivery.
Yeah. So basically, we're like a caterer. They know what's on our menu and we deliver directly to them. And it's a real benefit for all of the boutiques, mm-hmm. the art galleries, where there's maybe only one person manning their storefront and they can't
True.
Leave.
So, Gia, how far have you ever had to bike for a single order? What's your furthest range?
Oh, my. Well, I would say a couple miles. I would say at least 2 miles is a good range. We now actually have multiple bikes so we can cover more distance. We have 2 and we'd like to get a third because we have to start doing mid-city.
That's fantastic. Okay, so you had a very exciting experience recently, and you have actually moved out of your home kitchen.
Yes.
And you now have a real commissary kitchen.
We do.
Tell us about your new spot and where you are.
We are at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, which has a full industrial kitchen, which is wonderful, and we have what they call at the JCC, the Nosh, which is essentially like a little snack bar. And we provide fresh food for breakfast and lunch. And it's always seasonal, as locally grown and organic as we can get it.
And if somebody doesn't belong to the JCC, can they still pick food up there?
What I tell people is technically you have to be a member. But if you're not a member, same thing. Give me a call. I'll meet you. I'll meet you at the corner of St. Charles and Jefferson. Where do you want to meet? If I'm not on the bike, we'll figure it out.
That's really great customer service.
And well, I want to encourage people to eat healthy.
Uh-huh. Well, you make it so easy to eat healthy because your food is so absolutely delicious. I've enjoyed some pretty yummy things from you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody who knows me knows that healthy food is not usually number one on Poppy's list. I'm usually looking for something wicked, but you've really helped balance that out. So tell me, we know that you're tossing the salads and that beautiful, fresh salads are one of the linchpins of your business, but what are some other customer favorites?
You know, our soups are fantastic, and I actually can't even take credit for those. And this is a family business.
Yes.
My sister, who I refer to as my not-so-silent partner, was my initial investor. And my brother-in-law, who is our executive chef and who is French-trained, does all of our soups, and they are absolutely phenomenal. I think one of the best parts is soup is so nutritious just in its very basic form. You don't have to add creams and butters. And I know that's probably your favorite, some of your favorites.
Well, if he's French trained, you know, yes. You would expect that. But he's learned the green to go way, huh?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I will say, since he started working for me, he has lost 25 pounds.
Oh, my. Well, let's drop mm-hmm. his name. And didn't he come to you from Susan Spicer's kitchen at Biana?
He did. Mm-hmm. So Conrad Emerson, my brother-in-law, he makes all of the stocks from scratch.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, chicken stocks and veg stocks. And then when you start with something so rich in flavor to begin with, and you add in something like lentils or even just as simple as butternut squash, you just need the right amount of spice and you're green to go.
Okay, so we've got salads, we've got soups. What's for dessert?
Well, we always have fresh baked goods, of course. So one of the all-time favorites that is never coming off the menu is a carrot butterscotch bar.
Oh my goodness, what is that?
It's probably got a good 2 pounds of carrots in it and some butterscotch. And I couldn't take it off the menu if I tried. I would get a revolt. And our wraps are really popular, like spring roll wraps, mango, avocado, fresh veg, you name it.
Oh, you're making me so hungry. I'm coming right down the street to the JCC to see you soon, or I'm looking for that bike. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gia DeLeo of Green to Go. Chef Ryan Hughes is our Louisiana Eats ingredient specialist. Ryan's back and ready to inspire us with some new tastes. So, Ryan, what are you serving up today?
Well, I get to inspire and to serve. I love it, Poppy. One of the secret ingredients I picked up from classical French chef that I started with, and that was the use of a vinegar that's very special. It comes from the south of France region, northern Spain. And it's a derivative of banoules. And what it is, Poppy, it's a fortified wine. And what they do is, during the fermentation process, much like a sherry or a port, they add more alcohol to it. And that actually stops the fermentation. It doesn't raise the alcohol content too much, but they add more sugar and alcohol to it. And it makes it sweet.
So it's a wine that is then made into a vinegar?
Exactly. So it can be served as a wine, but the way that our chefs like to use it is with the vinegar.
Okay.
Okay. And why would we want to use it as a vinegar? It's a way to add complexity to a dish. It's the whole balance of flavors. You get the sweetness. So the banoules, obviously, because they add sugar and alcohol to it, it's got a little bit of sweetness to it. Mm-hmm. And the way I can describe it to your listeners is it's got like an aroma of plums.
Ooh.
Exactly. Everyone goes, that smells good. I gotta order this. But then the flavor is very, very mild. So it's got almost like a gingerbread, nutmeg, kind of vanilla kind of taste to it at the same time. You can either have red banoules or you can have white, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So what are the two different things that you would do with the red versus the white?
Well, that's a good question. One of my favorite things to do with the red is down here in Louisiana, we've got these beautiful oysters.
Yes.
And I know a lot of us will be like, oh, my gosh, this is sacrosanct. We can't put, you know, mignonettes with our oysters. So mignonette is the French version of you take a vinegar and you add chopped shallots to it and a little bit of black pepper and you serve that on the side and you spoon that on top of your raw oysters.
Yeah, if you're going to put something on a raw oyster, a mignonette is a whole lot more delicate and lets the oyster shine through than some of those big, heavy, whacked out ketchup cocktail sauces.
Well, here in Louisiana, we love our ketchup and a horseradish and whatnot.
So, Ryan, this seems counterintuitive to me because we're talking about oysters and you're right. Saying that's what you use the red banoules vinegar on.
I use the red banoules on the mignonettes.
And what about the white? What do you do with that?
Well, that's a great question. The red has a little bit more oomph to it.
Uh-huh.
And the white is even lighter. So imagine like a white wine vinegar or a red wine vinegar. The white is really good for salad dressings and vinaigrettes. It's perfect.
So is this relatively easy to find? Where can we buy this?
Well, I guess that's the chef's secrets.
Oh, come on now.
No, I can tell you. You can look online. Look up on Amazon. There's a lot of different vendors out there that start importing them. Do a little research. And once you find a place, you know, online where you can get reliable products like that, in New Orleans itself, there's a couple of purveyors that I use that will get it.
Well, thank God for the internet, huh?
Thank God for the internet. We can find anything these days.
And thank God for all of those interesting ingredients you're always willing to share with us on Louisiana Eats. So thanks, Ryan. Please come back soon.
Anytime to share my secrets with you, Bobby.
Thanks. Chef Ryan Hughes, our Louisiana Eats culinary consultant. After the next short break, Amy Lawrence and Justin Fox Burks transform traditional Southern food into vegetarian wonders. So, which tropical fruit can be turned into believable bacon? We'll be right back with the answer to that culinary mystery. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Everybody roasts winter vegetables like carrots and potatoes, but whether you're an okra lover or an okra hater, roasted okra will change your life. Okra's mucilaginous slime is what turns most people off, but when it's roasted, that slime somehow concentrates into something altogether different, giving you an unusually silky mouthfeel that I've never experienced with another food. And it's so fast and easy. Preheat an oven to 450 degrees. Rinse the whole okra pods, then toss in olive oil and balsamic vinegar, about a tablespoon of each per pound. Lay the okra in a single layer on a baking sheet and put them into the hot oven. Then set your timer for 5 minutes, and when it goes off, stir them well and reset that timer again. I know I can't keep track of 5 minutes in my kitchen. After a total of about 15 minutes, your okra is ready for a light sprinkling of salt, and voila! They're like healthy green French fries. They're good served with cocktails before dinner, as a side dish with dinner, or as an after-school treat your kids will shockingly gobble up. Roasted okra are meaty and satisfying enough to become the centerpiece of Meatless Monday meals for folks wanting to dabble in the world of vegetarianism. You'll find this recipe in my new book, Louisiana Eats, or on our website, louisianaeatsradio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and roasted okra are real Louisiana Eats.
Everything I do gonna be for funky. From now on, everything I do gon' be funky. From now on, yeah. Everything I do.
Southern natives Amy Lawrence and Justin Fox Burks have totally revolutionized the stereotype of down-home, smothered-to-death Southern veggies with their new book, The Southern Vegetarian Cookbook. Welcome to Louisiana Eats, you revolutionaries.
Oh, thank you so much. We're so glad to be talking to you.
Yeah, we really appreciate you having us.
Well, together you all began a blog that's called The Chubby Vegetarian. In fact, when you all began this whole transformation, part of the transformation was that you all lost more than 100 pounds combined during the life change. So why did you call the blog The Chubby Vegetarian?
Well, it was completely true when we started in 2008. I weighed 265 pounds. That's a big boy. It's easy to fool yourself, I think, when you're a vegetarian, thinking, I'm a vegetarian, I'm eating vegetables, I'm doing the right thing, I walk the dogs around the block, and I ride my bike every once in a while. It's easy to tell yourself that you're doing the right things, because you are, in a sense, doing some of the right things. But when you're doing the right things, say, eating your broccoli, and smothering it in tons of cheese, then you're taking the right thing and going in the wrong direction with it. With the blog, it was a way for us to look at exactly what we were eating, log it, and there's no fooling yourself about what's going on when you look at the picture, you read the words, and you go, oh, I see.
Well, actually, Justin, that's your great specialty. You're the picture taker.
That's right. I'm a photographer by trade. I've been a professional photographer here in Memphis for the past 15 years. Believe it or not, it's the one thing that has improved my cooking more than anything, because as a photographer, I've gotten to know a lot of great chefs. I've been in their kitchens. I've watched them cook. It's like cooking school every single day of my life with some of the greatest chefs you can imagine down here.
The classic Southern menu is what's typically called the meat and three. and that usually indicates three side dishes. So how does that become transformed at your table?
Well, we don't really like to use meat substitutes, so we make our own things out of mushrooms and different vegetables. So it's all about getting more vegetables on the plate, making it healthier when we can, but still having it be appetizing. Southern food doesn't have the best reputation sometimes for health, but we're trying to go more in that direction.
Well, let's also make it clear, frying is still an allowable cooking method for the Southern vegetarian.
Sure. I think we have maybe one deep fried thing, and that was just unavoidable. We try and do things like pan fry with a little bit of oil. We try and use less butter, less oil, less cheese. We try and have our feet pointed in the right direction. Of course, there are things that still make the food delicious, but we just try to use them judiciously.
Well, of course, bacon, you know, that wicked, wicked bacon is often the great depth that is the flavor found in most Southern vegetables. So what do you do to achieve that end without enlisting the pig?
I have a theory about bacon. And it goes something like this. The thing that people love about bacon is the saltiness and the smokiness and the richness. Now, all three of those things can be achieved minus our friend the pig. There's a great recipe for smoked coconut bacon. We smoke these coconut shavings, toss it in some soy sauce, and then you bake it off. It becomes crispy and rich and salty and wonderful. In fact, we served it at a restaurant recently for an event. We did it as a BLT. They say, I see the lettuce, I see the tomato, I see the bacon. Where is the coconut? I said, the coconut is the bacon. They said, no, that's the bacon. I was like, well, it's not bacon, it's coconut.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I find the most interesting about the two of you is because neither of you are professional chefs. You're right. Just home cooks. But where do you get these crazy out-of-the-box ideas like how to turn coconut into bacon?
Well, we're inspired definitely by chefs and by things that we see. And we found that if you ask a question or ask people to share, they will. And then I'm really big on saying, what if? What if we did it like this? Or what if we put these two things in combination? You know, we just experiment, and everyone in the family and all of our friends are pretty good cooks, too. So we're always sharing food, sharing recipes, talking about cooking. So it's just a culture down here, I think.
Jesse Kimball, he has a place called the Memphis Tap Room. It's actually not in Memphis. But we ran across him and got in touch with him, and he was kind enough to share his recipe for smoked coconut bacon with us. We give him full credit in the book, and any chefs that have taught us things, we definitely give them credit. We have a great recipe from our friend Kelly English, who owns Restaurant Iris. He's one of your native sons. Worked with John Besh in August and then came here and opened up Iris. So we've got his midnight snack in here. Instead of shrimp, we use artichoke hearts and mushrooms. It's really just an amazing dish.
Mushrooms play a really important part in a lot of your cooking. Would you talk to us about the place of mushrooms on your menus and how you use them?
I've always been a fan, and it's one of our missions in life, I think, to get people to appreciate things that they think maybe they wouldn't like. And mushrooms are one of those things, and we hear it all the time. I don't like mushrooms, but when I make things from your book, I love them. And I think any product that is treated with care and respect and cooked properly can be appreciated by people. Take beets, for example. You know, most people, their only contact with beets is opening up a can and tasting them. And those pickled canned beets, I'm sorry, whoever makes these things, they're terrible.
Yeah, not very good.
They're not good. But if you take a fresh beet from the ground, you roast it and you peel it, it's a revolution for people when they taste something like that. But back to the question about mushrooms, they're meaty. They accept spice, they accept flavor really well. It's not a fake meat. It's its own thing, but it stands in really well. So we try and take those vegetables and just take them from the sidelines and push them to the center of the plate.
There's another thing you do that simply mystifies me. Let's talk about eggplant andouille.
I looked at a Japanese eggplant, and I thought, that thing looks like a sausage. You don't have to process it to look like a sausage. There it is, just waiting for the spices. So I peeled that sucker up. Maybe we don't even peel it on this. You just add the spices right to them, cut on the bias, and you can saute them up in a pan, get a nice crust on the outside of them. They are hugely delicious. We served them at a secret supper that we chefed just about a month ago, and that alongside some pickled blackberries and grilled zucchini was really the hit of the night.
Well, for somebody who's just getting ready to maybe entertain the idea of crossing over to vegetarianism or something close to it, what are your best suggestions?
My best suggestion would be to just try it every once in a while. Try Meatless Monday. Maybe go vegetarian before dinner and then have a regular old dinner. Our mission is not to get everybody in the world to become a strict vegetarian. You know, it's not that way in our house. But we think the more good vegetables that people have on their plate, maybe, possibly, they'll forgo some of the other things.
And I think pick something you already like. If you really like chili, a lot of people who have bought the book have had success with our chili recipe. And if you already like it, you know, try it this way. We think it's going to have a lot of flavor to it, and you might not have it all the time, but it's a great thing to know how to make, especially if you have people in the family who are vegetarian too.
Well, what place do you all see your recipes fitting on a traditional Southern table?
I can speak from experience. You know, I told you about our 12-foot-long dining table where we eat dinner. We've set up our house to be able to have family gatherings. My brothers are vegetarian and I am. We have meat eaters and vegetarians and gluten-free and paleo in our family. We've got it all. And our food feeds everyone. So where is this place on the table? Right in the middle. You know, I mean, I think it's the thing that everyone can eat. We think it's more appealing than maybe some of the traditional vegetarian foods that you would think of. It's less sprouts and hippy-dippy and more practical.
And, you know, I think that I haven't met anyone in the past few years who doesn't have either a major health concern or a minor health concern, and it's really something to think about in the South. And so if we can make things a little bit healthier and move more in that direction, you know, not everything in our book is health food for sure because it's, you know, small steps, but I think it's just a need in the South, too. We need to all be eating better.
Well, I can tell you, I have never wanted to cook as many recipes from a cookbook. It must be the Southern girl in me, or maybe it's just the real ingredients that you all use. So congratulations. Love your book.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot coming from you.
Justin Fox Burks and Amy Lawrence of the blog The Chubby Vegetarian and their new book, The Southern Vegetarian. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll go down in the Treme for stories and recipes from the heart of New Orleans with Lolas Eli.
The themes we deal with, food, music, architecture, and culture and community, these are the things that I try to deal with in my column and the things that make me want to be a New Orleanian so much.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, LCI Workers Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Life Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to producers Thomas Walsh and Margaret Howes. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO New Orleans.